Welcome to this Arena Galway Film FLA and IFTA special event, a public interview with an actor that has brought us such unforgettable roles as Hannibal Lecter in Manhunter, the doubting Winston in Churchill, in theatre King Lear and Titus Andronicus, and of course, founder and CEO of Waystar Royco, and winner of a Golden Globe Award for his portrayal of Logan Roy in Succession. Give a big Galway welcome to Brian Cox. Brian, you're so welcome to this arena.
Clearly, I'm moved beyond, you know, this is amazing. Absolutely amazing. Thank you.
You have a distinguished and varied career. Is it strange now that your career-defining role is Logan Roy in Succession?
Well, you know, the thing I always prized was my anonymity. The fact that people ever never quite... They said, oh, you were in... No, you weren't. Oh, yeah, you were in... Oh, yeah, didn't you... No, you didn't do that. That was my career, really. And occasionally they got it right. But Logan Roy... just changed the whole thing. I mean, I'm so kind of... I do miss my anonymity. I do miss the fact that I can't be the Brian Cox I was. I now have to filter myself through Logan Roy, but such is life. And at my age, I shouldn't complain.
Like Logan Roy, you are both displaced Scots. You both grew up in Dundee, and then...
Well, that was... Let me tell you about that, because... Mm-hmm. Originally, Logan Roy didn't come from Dundee. Originally, he came from Quebec in Canada. And when I spoke to both Jesse Armstrong, the creator, wonderful creator of our show, and Adam McKay, who was the guy who was the main producer and director of the first episode, the pilot, and we were talking, and they said, you know. And I said, well, you know, he could be Scots. And they said, oh, and Jesse said, oh, no, he's got to be American. He's got to be American. He has to come from the States. He has to come from the States. He has to be American. Adam McKay, on the other hand, of course, in Scotland, we would call him Adam McKay. But Adam McKay, he said, well, I don't think that's a bad idea. No, he's got, and Jesse insisted he had to be American. So anyway, we get to the first episode. And as always, you get your script almost... Never, but at the last minute. And there it was, born in Quebec, Canada. And I thought, well, that's not the United States. I said, and I haven't been doing a Canadian accent. I've been doing some kind of American accent, so I'd like to have known. But so anyway, so the first episode was shot, and that was it. I was born in Quebec, Canada. And I said this to Jesse. He said, oh, it's fine. You'll just do general American. I said, okay, fine. And then on the 9th episode of the first season was the wedding of Shiv and Tom. And I was sitting in this amazing set way down in Herefordshire. We had this amazing house. And I was sitting there with Peter Friedman, who plays Frank, who I keep firing and rehiring. He was the one who did the speech where I was, he mentions Quebec, Canada. And he said, and he told me, this is the 9th episode. And he says, oh, Brian, they've just changed your birthplace. And I said, what do you mean they've just changed my birthplace? He said, well, you're no longer born in Quebec. I said, well, so where am I born? And he said, I don't know. He said, I can't remember. He said, oh, let me look it up. And he goes through his device and he's going, oh, yeah, somewhere called Dundee, Scotland. And I said, but that's where I was born. And he said, well, that's a coincidence. I said, it's a hell of a fucking coincidence. And I went up to Jesse and I said, what's going on? I said, you know, what is it? I said, you know, I'm suddenly you're saying America, then he's Quebec and it's not America and it doesn't matter. Now I'm Dundee. He said, we thought it'd be a little surprise. I said, it's a hell of a fucking surprise. And please don't do any more of them from now on.
If we could stay in Dundee for a little while, I was reading your autobiography and you talked about your parents and you said they were people of their imagination. Mm. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think my mum particularly was like a lot of working class women throughout, everywhere. They were sort of never given a chance to be who they should be. And I think my mum could have been a writer, actually. And she was very funny. She was just very odd and funny and, you know, she was lovely. But she got very ill when my dad died. She had a series of massive nervous breakdowns. But she was very funny. And my dad was a kind of, he fostered people of imaginative potential. That's what he did. He kind of looked after people and put them in the right place. He was a very, very kind, very sweet man. And so that was what they did, you know.
And then when you were just 8, tragedy hit the family. Yeah. Your beloved father died. Mm. And that was not only a catastrophe for a young boy losing your dad, but it was also a catastrophe for the family because you were thrown into poverty.
Well, what happened is my dad and mum, they always had this big debate between them. She always used to say to me as a child, she said, just remember, Brian, charity begins at home. But my dad believed that charity was charity. He made quite a bit of money during the war because he had a shop. It was a received occupation. He was also a special constable as well, which he did in his nights. And he gave a lot of money to people who were starting up businesses, particularly in the building trade, because there was a lot of building was happening in Dundee after the war. So he made 28 grand, which was a lot of money. But it all went horribly wrong because of various crooked lawyers and what have you. And then he died. And what happened was that we got these papers of, you know, about this property that we owned, but we couldn't get hold of it. And then we got his bank book, and he only had £10 in the bank. So we were pitched into pretty hard circumstances.
Yes, with your mother she was in
a hospital for nervous diseases on and off for about 2 years.
And that experience of poverty so early in your life, as you grew up then and became a working actor, did that affect your attitude to work?
Poverty is like the Damocles sword that hangs over my head, because I didn't want to be identified with this kind of carefree Logan Roy, you know, because he is the antithesis, absolute antithesis who I am as a man. He's everything that I really don't like, quite honestly. But he's a joy to play.
Then when you were, was it 14, somebody in your school recommended you go to the Dundee Rep?
Well, what happened was there was two guys in my school, George Hackett and a guy called Bill Dewar, who introduced me to the theatre, because my thing as a kid was the movies. I was crazy about the movies, and I wanted to be, an American actor. That's what I was, you know. But then I realized that I couldn't be an American actor. It was only when I saw Albert Finney at the Plaza Cinema when I was 14, and I thought, oh, because of his incredible performance, I thought, wow, this is a road that I could go down. So they got me an interview with this. There was a young man who had been at my school. He had a job, and it was only a general factotum job where you took money to the bank. And I went into the interview. It was a very sort of kind of odd day because I went to the front of the theater. The woman at the front said, sorry, son, you can't come in here. If you want to get to the front, you have to go to the back. You go to the back, you can get to the back to the front, but you can't get to the front through the front. You've also got to go. And so this woman sort of, and I said, oh, okay. So I went around the back to get to the front. And as I went in, there was two people having a huge row on the staircase. I mean, really, almost fisticuffs row. And one actor was an actor called Nicol Williamson. But he was giving it, you know, to this other guy who was a stage manager. So I thought, wow, this is amazing. So I was trying to get up to my interview, so I was squeezing past them. And as I got to the platform, the sort of landing outside the stage, there was an actor there called Gordon Granger, and he was smoking a cigarette, and he looked at me and he said, are you all right, darling? And I thought, that man just called me darling. And those two guys were knocking hell out of one another. Well, clearly this is the place that I must be. So I went for my interview, and of course I knew nothing about anything. I mean, and the very nice New Zealand man called John Henderson, he said, are you interested in classical music? And the week before this, our music teacher had played the trumpet march from Aida by Verdi. And I remembered that, and he said, are you interested in music? I said, Yes, I like music. And he said, any particular composer? I said, Verdi. I love Verdi. And I said, and particularly the trumpet march from Aida, I really think is one of the... Of course, he knew I was black, you know, you could see through me. But anyway, I got the job, and my job was to... Basically, I was working in front of house. They wouldn't let me backstage. I was too dangerous for that. So I would mop the stage at 6:30. That would be the end of my day. That was my last task of the day. But I spent most of the day going on errands. The great thing about the theatre is we're all the same. It's probably the most egalitarian place, you know, because we all suffer from the same, you know, disappointments and the same successes. We all share it. It comes and goes, and it's a hard, hard life for people. And that was the great thing and because I had a fractured family, I suddenly found myself with a family, and that was wonderful. That have that sense of family and sense of family about doing what you want to do was, I just think, incredibly lucky.
Now, in the fullness of time, of course, you moved to Birmingham, then to London, and worked with all the greats like Laurence Olivier, John Gielgud. But it was people like, you mentioned, Albert Finney and Tom Courtney, that you saw a pathway for you.
I think that what people don't realise is, I mean, there are probably people of my age now who do realise it, but the 60s was the most incredible time. It really was. And to be in London in the 60s, you know, Chelsea, swinging London, I mean, that was one side of it. But the other side of it was that you were welcomed. They were very happy to you to be there. And I got a full grant. My mother was a widow. I got all my expenses paid, all my tutorials paid, and also my rent. Everything was covered. And also I came out with a few quid at the end of the week as well. It was an amazing time. And I mean, I had more money than I'd ever had. And sadly, now there is no pathway to the theatre, particularly for working class kids. And it's one of the great upsets I have, that, you know, kids like me couldn't have the same journey that I had, which was a wonderful journey because, you know, they're wonderful actors, the Eddie Redmaynes and the Benedict Cumberbatches and the Dominic West, but they came through the public school system where they had the most amazing facilities. I mean, the theatre in Eton is like an extraordinary theatre. But it's difficult. It's impossible now for kids. They don't have that. They don't. I mean, I think Ireland, you've got a better sense of it. You know, I think you really do have a sense of it. But certainly in England and in Scotland now, you don't have it at all.
And you were seeing people on the screen and sometimes on stage, people like Albert Finney, people like Richard Harris,
exactly.
Tom Courtney.
That generation, you know, which was, they were really the tail end of the 50s and into the beginning 60s. You know, Peter O'Toole, Albert Finney, Tom Courtney, Alan Bates, Brian Bedford, Keith Beckett. There was a whole bunch of actors. And then at Central, there was Judy Dench, there was Vanessa Redgrave. So there was this amazing influx of these actors. And in the working class was very much Albert, Tom, Alan. You know, they were the northern lads. And it was a whole new thing that had happened. Because before that, we were all playing, it was all forelock tugging, you know. And that shifted. The 50s shifted that. That paradigm shifted considerably. But unfortunately, it sort of crept back now, you know.
And then you did all the classic roles. You did Lear, you did Titus Andronicus. But there was a kind of acting that was either fashionable or related to the classical style. I think you call it front-footing, which is quite different to the kind of more realist style that you liked.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I did a lot of... There was a sort of style of classical acting, which still exists, which I kind of fell into, just in terms of trying to get success. And of course, I have a voice, and I played a lot of great roles. So by the time I was 22, I'd played Bolingbroke and Richard II, Orlando and As You Like It, Mercutio and Romeo and Juliet, Iago and Othello, and Peer Gynt. And that's an extraordinary thing for a 22-year-old to have done. And I wasn't any good at any of them, but, you know, it was such a great training. And there was a sort of style of acting that Olivier kind of had set up, really, more than anybody. This sort of braggadocio. Ah, my boy, we can do it like this, or we can do it like that, or we can do this and this and this, you know. And it wasn't quite me, no. But I thought, oh, okay, okay. And you see people who made it their own, like Tony Hopkins, and did it. But still, I've always felt that was, and it wasn't actually until only about 15 years ago when I worked with Vanessa in a film of Coriolanus, which Ray Fiennes, and we were doing Shakespeare on film, and then I realized how conversational you could be. Vanessa has this wonderful way of being natural and quite domestic, and yet at the same time having a sort of stance about her in her acting, and I just thought, that's interesting what she does. She's not working the text. She's allowing it to speak and just being in the middle of it, being absolutely straight up in the middle of it. And it was a great lesson.
And what was it like then being a realist actor coming up against the front-footed actors?
Well, it was okay. I mean, I think that my acting is I've always taken the part and never, no part is ever crossed over to another part. I always make them as total separate entities. So I think I was lucky just because of who I was. It's, you know, because I did well in the theatre, you know. I mean, I played Lear when I was 44, you know, so you can't really complain about it. I had no, you know, I had no complaints. But at the same time, you're seeing the fashion of theatre, the way theatre's going, and you're trying to write it out. And of course, my great thing always at the back of my head was movies. I wanted to do movies. And luckily enough, the British television industry was fantastic. And that was in the 70s, late 70s. And I had the time of my life, you know, doing a thing called The Devil's Crown, which I did about Henry II. And then I did a wonderful thing called Thérèse Racan, which was a Zola with a marvelous actress called Kate Nelligan. So I had a great time in that way. It was really good. And I could do all that in television and then also gravitating to film. And then, but when I got to 50, I realized the world had become quite small. And I thought, I've got to get out. So I decided to go to the States. I decided it was time to go to the States and see what would happen. Now, everybody was kind of, why would you want to go to the States? You've got this great opportunity here. I said, because I'm still in a process of discovery. And I think that is what life is about anyway. I think we're endlessly discovering things. Otherwise, you know, nothing would move. And that was my process of trying to discover where I was, why I was doing it. And going to the States, I decided I was going to be a character actor. I was going to be, you know, I'd been a leading actor in the theater. But I didn't see, and I still don't, I don't see any right to hold on to those ideas of what it should be or should be. I remember having a conversation with Nigel Hawthorne on a plane, and he was talking about what a miserable time he had playing second fiddle to Sylvester Stallone, you know, and he was going on about this in a film that he did with, I can't remember what the film was called, but he was going, I said, you know, I've come to a point, and I said, you know, Nigel, I don't think that really matters. What matters is the work itself and what you're doing. It doesn't matter, you know, the idea that you have to think about your status. I just think it's nonsense. And I said, anyway, I'll swap you Sly Stallone for Steven Seagal any day. And believe me, once you work with Steven Seagal, well.
Well, I think we should go to Hollywood and show a clip now for the audience.
Not of Steven Seagal.
No. I think something much more fantastic. So, as you said, Hollywood entered the picture in the mid-1980s when you played the part of Hannibal Lecter in Michael Mann's Manhunter. Oh. Here, the imprisoned murderer, Hannibal Lecter, is visited by former FBI agent Will Graham, played by William Peterson, who wants Lecter to help him in tracking down a serial killer.
You want to know how he's choosing them, don't you?
I thought you might have some ideas.
Why should I tell you?
You get to see the file in this case. And there's another reason.
Pray tell.
Thought you might be curious to see if you're smarter than the person I'm looking for.
Then by implication, you think you're smarter than me since you caught me.
No. I know that I'm not smarter than you.
Then how did you catch me?
You had disadvantages.
What disadvantages?
You're insane.
You are very tan, Will.
Your hands are rough. They don't look like cop's hands anymore. And that shaving lotion is something a child would select. It has a ship on the bottle, doesn't it? Don't think you can persuade me with appeals to my intellectual vanity.
I don't think I'll persuade you at all. You'll either do it or you won't. Besides, we have Dr. Bloom working on it, and he's the best.
Do you have the file with you?
Yes.
Pictures?
Yes.
Let me have them, and I might consider it.
No.
Dream much, Will.
Goodbye, Dr. Lecter.
You haven't threatened to take away my books yet. Let me have the file, and I'll tell you what I think.
That was, of course, one of your most acclaimed roles.
Yeah.
And how much screen time did you have?
I think it's about 12 minutes, I think, altogether. But it's so weird because I remember I was working with Michael Mann and we were talking about Hannibal and Hannibal's sense of language and what he is. And he said, you know, I think, you know, he could be like a public schoolboy, you know, like, you know, those annoying public schoolboys are like, you know, he could be. He said, do you know any public schoolboys? And I said, no, I don't know any. And then I forgot. I said, oh, I do know one. And he said, who's that? I said, my son. So actually, whenever I see that, I always think of my son, Alan, because he reminds me more of Alan than anybody, and because he could be quite like that.
Before you made the move to Hollywood, in 1995, there were two Scottish films, both with a strong connection with Ireland. Obviously, part of Braveheart was made here in Ireland. And then Rob Roy was the other film, which of course starred Liam Neeson in the title role. And you, even though it was the same year and there were Scottish films, you got very good parts in both films.
Yeah, well, I never changed hotel rooms. I stayed in the same hotel room because I went literally from one to the other. I just preferred the script of Rob Roy. I mean, I'd actually played William Wallace, you know, so I played the part. None of that, what was in that film, was true. I mean, it was all, you know, dramatically sort of souped up. Whereas the Rob Roy was a much more accurate script and actually a better, sharper, and I think ultimately a better script. The problem was the director was not as good as Mel Gibson. I mean, Mel was amazing. He was amazing on the way he ran the set, the way he spoke with the actors, the way he worked with the actors. He was just incredible. I mean, I have a lot of time for Mel Gibson, and he gets quite maligned, Mel, but he's actually a really good man.
Yes, and your character in Rob Roy was a rather loathsome character.
Oh yeah, horrible.
Wasn't he?
I mean, I don't even find Hannibal Lecter as horrible as I find Killearn in Rob Roy. He was a really nasty, nasty individual, kind of lowlife who came to a bad end. And it was a difficult part to play because he had absolutely no redeeming features whatsoever. But he was funny, you know. And that counts for a lot.
You talked about making that conscious decision to move to America to be a character actor. And you worked with some of the most exciting directors, Spike Lee, Wes Anderson, Spike Jones, in wonderful films like you were Robert McKee, the script advisor in Adaptation, which was such a wonderfully cynical part.
Yeah, you know, I just thought that it's such a great speech, you know, when he says, you know, fuck all about life. And it's something that was very true to heart for me, you know, about a lot of would-be writers who come along with their ideas and you go, what is this, you know? What are you giving me here? You know, so as an actor, I've suffered from that.
And equally as Spike Lee in 25th Hour, that's another great part.
Yeah.
It's, again, not a huge amount of film time, but you're the father of the Edward Norton character.
Yeah. What was so exciting about it was Spike Lee. I mean, Spike Lee is, I think, it would be unkind to say he's the best, but he's certainly one of the top directors and one of the most admired directors. I love Spike Lee because he puts you in exactly the right position. So you feel immediately at home and you feel that you can do your work. Just a great, great imagination. I remember with Edward Norton, because Edward fancied himself as a... Can I borrow your pages? He fancied himself as a writer, you know, and so he's... I'll borrow your pen as well. So Edward comes up to Spike and he goes, "Now, Spike, I've been looking at the script and I just think there are a couple of things that we could lose. I think we could lose this, and I think that doesn't quite work, and this, and I think it'd be better if I said this, because I think this is really, really more to the point than that, which I don't think is to the point at all." So and Spike went, and he took the script and he went, "Yeah. Yeah, this is good. This is very good. Anyway, so what we're going to do is..." It's the best put-down I've ever seen.
So let's play another clip. You also did a lot of blockbuster films, as you mentioned, Mr. Seagal, but this isn't him either. This is where you got the chance to play a lot of villains. Perhaps one of the more memorable ones is Ward Abbott in the Bourne movie series. You are one of the bad men behind Operation Treadstone that has led to Matt Damon's character going on the run and losing his girlfriend. Here you're finally confronted by Jason Bourne about your past evil deeds.
"I don't suppose it'll do me much good to cry for help, huh?"
"Not much. You killed her."
"It was a mistake. It was supposed to be you. There were files linking me to the Nesky murder. If the files disappeared and they suspected you, they'd be chasing a ghost for 10 years.
"So we got in the way. Is that why Nesky died? Is that why you killed Marie?"
"You killed Marie. The minute you climbed into a car, the minute you entered her life, she was dead."
"I told you people to leave us alone.
I fell off the grid. I was halfway around the world."
"There's no place that won't catch up to you. It's how every story ends. It's what you are, Jason. A killer. You always will be."
"Go ahead. Go on. Go on. Do it. Do it."
"She wouldn't want me to. It's the only reason you're alive."
You've seen that in a long time.
When you're playing somebody like that who seems cold and calculating, is it hard to find the spark to get into characters like that?
No. I mean, sorry, that is the short answer. I don't know, it's the imagination. You know, if you're open, I mean, you know, there are a lot of actors who kind of, for acting is a religious experience, you know. It has never been a religious experience. I'm not religious anyway, so it's never been a religious experience. And I just think that we're transmitters of energy. And if you let the imagination do the work, the energy hits you and you bring it out, you know, and you create your character, you do what you're supposed to do, and you know what your intention is, you know why you're in the scene, there are things you've discovered about your character. He likes these kind of clothes as opposed to that kind of clothes, and you do that. There are actors, of course, who make that, as I say, a religious experience. And like Dan Day-Lewis, for example, who's a brilliant, brilliant actor. You know, I mean, really one of the best actors ever, no question. But the problem with Dan is he really gets so involved. And he's worn himself out, you know. He's 55 and he's retired. Just when the parts get better.
And you worked with him on Jim Sheridan's The Boxer.
Yeah, which was great.
And is it awkward, is it difficult for other cast members when the lead character is doing method and completely in the role?
It's not difficult, but the thing about what we do is that we are part of an ensemble. It's not just about you. It's about you in relationship to other people, what's going on. And sometimes, and it's a particular American disease, that for the American actor, it's about my character, what I'm doing. You can't do it like that. And you can't do that. You've got to be open. You've got to be open for anything that shifts, any movement that goes, and it doesn't, you know, you may have to rub it out and start again, you know. And I find that really, I find a lot of American actors get themselves into such a state about what they're doing. And I go, you know, you're giving yourself a short life and a short career. Just, I mean, I'm 78 and I'm still enjoying it as much as I ever did. And I still feel that looseness and that energy that transmits energy. And that's, to me, what it's about. You know, you do what you do, you do the work, you get the guy, you get him where you want him, you get him what you think, and then you let it go. You don't hold on and say, well, I got to live like this, I got to go to the toilet like this. You know, that's bollocks, you know. You wipe your ass the way you wipe your ass.
So could we go to theater for a while? Because having gone to America, maybe the opportunities for theater then, you had to sacrifice those concentrating on film. But then you met a very young playwright called Conor McPherson.
Absolutely.
Tell us, how did you meet him and how did it come about you began working with him?
It was Michael Bradwell, who was running the Bush Theatre in London. And he said, there's this young Irish playwright who's written this one-man play called St. Nicholas. And he said, what do you think? Would you read it? And I was a bit nervous because one-man plays are tough, you know, because it's just you. There's nobody that you can, you know, depend on except yourself. And I met Conor and immediately was like, you know, one had found a soulmate, you know. I mean, he is astonishing, and I think he is the great young Irish writer. And he's just full of soul, full of heart, I did The Weir. Well, that was later, I did The Weir. And then I did Dublin Carol, which opened at Royal Court. And I just think Conor is it. In fact, he's written a new play, which I'd love to do. Unfortunately, I can't because I'm otherwise engaged. But he's a wonderful writer, just a wonderful writer. And of course, I've never, ever, ever lost sense of what the theatre means to me. I mean, when I was a kid, it was about cinema. But then I learned what the value of the theatre was and what the value of the live experience is. And the live experience, like this now, it's unique. There's nothing like it. So I love that aspect of it. And that's why I've always, when I finished doing playing in Succession, I said, I am going back to the theatre. I'm going to go and do as much theatre as I can. Because now I could also afford it. You know, because a lot of the times, that matters. You've got to be able to afford it. You know, now I can do that. I can take those risks. And that's the big advantage of it.
One of the plays you did after Succession was Long Day's Journey and Tonight, yeah. Where you played James Tyrone. And he's a man who he's an Irish man. He became a great actor, but limited his career by doing the same role over and over. But he was plagued by the poverty of his youth.
Yeah, it's probably, arguably, the most painful role I've ever played. James, because we have so much in common. I realized that Tyrone he had that thing about poverty, which I had, and he had this thing of a big success, which he wanted to follow, and finally he hated it. And I never did that. I've always wanted to cut and go. I've never been in this place where I wanted to stick around. I've always dared myself to do things. That's why the variety of stuff I've done is exactly about that. I've never identified with the character so much as him. I knew that everything he said about how being poor was true, and it wasn't about miserliness. If you come from a particular background where you've had nothing, you value what you've got, and you think, well, and you get nervous about it. You know, I'm doing not too badly now, but I still think, how am I going to earn? What am I going to do? What am I going to do? Can I do this voiceover? That'll pay for that. I'm still doing that in my mind, which is, I can't shake it off. Perhaps I should see a therapist. I'm not.
Let's go to another clip. I think we can probably all agree that you deserve to win an Oscar for your portrayal of Winston Churchill in Churchill. Let's play a clip from Churchill where he is confronted by the head of the Allied Army. This is Dwight Eisenhower, played by John Slattery, about his lack of confidence in the D-Day plan.
There was a hell of a speech today, Winston. Hell of a speech.
Much needed to be said.
I wish you'd said some of it to me earlier.
Well, you said yourself you welcome criticism.
I do. I welcome any thoughts on how to increase Overlord's chances of success, decrease casualties, shorten supply lines. But to start talking about turning it into a totally different operation in front of the men who've spent months planning it, in front of the King of England, well, that could be seen as unhelpful.
Unhelpful. You must remember, Ike, we fought the Germans in France before. Even if you break through in Normandy, even with the massive casualties, civilian and military, what will our boys face in France? Another Western Front? Passchendaele? The Somme? Trench warfare.
Winston, we have an air force. We have self-propelled artillery, armored divisions. The age of pushing infantry to the front is over.
Operation Overlord is not the only way of winning this war. I should know. I've seen a great many wars.
Sure. Some of them in the last century.
I beg your pardon.
The war you're talking about was 30 years ago. I don't think you truly appreciate how much things have moved on.
It's a great aspect of Churchill, isn't it? There's great visual imagery to show that difference.
The thing about Churchill, he constructed himself. He really did the hat and the V sign, and you know, he created the V sign and the cigar. But it was a construct.
Getting back to the Oscar.
Oscar. Oh, yeah.
The Oscar you didn't receive for Churchill. Well, and, of course, Gary Oldman. It was the same year, wasn't it?
Yeah,
2017.
Yeah, it was.
Got it for The Darkest Hour. Seems rather unfair.
The problem with Oscar season is it's a season. The thing is, if you get your film out in June, you're screwed for the Oscars. No matter how good the film is, you get screwed. Because the Oscar season is between Thanksgiving and Christmas. And everybody tries to get the film out at that time. They didn't do that with my film, our film rather. They didn't do that. They just let it go out in June, and I knew that it was a goner straight away. And then when that rather poor film got nominated, and I mean, Gary was all right, but I was better.
Another Oscar that was lost was for Hannibal Lecter, and of course, much later on...
This is the story of my life, the man who lost the Oscar, or the man who lost Oscars.
Well, you've a lot of other awards, but Anthony Hopkins won it for The Silence of the Lambs in 1991, after you had done the definitive Hannibal Lecter in 85.
Do you want me to say anything about that?
Yeah, I'd love you to say something about that.
Well, you know, I love Tony Hopkins, I really do. And, you know, Hannibal Lecter is a part that can be played now. It's a bit like Hamlet. You could play, you know, we've had Mads Mikkelsen, we've had Tony Hopkins, we've had the boy who played the young one. You know, it's going to go on. They're going to do endless things and remakes about Hannibal Lecter. So it's a bit like a part that you inhabit and you have your own view on. And Tony, being Tony, that was an extraordinary performance, and it hit the zeitgeist of the time. Our film, I still think, is a better film because of Michael. The only thing I don't like about Manhunter is the music, because it's very 80s, and I wasn't a big fan of the 80s music. But sorry to any people here who are fans of the 80s music. But that's what made the difference. But I just felt that with both those Oscar things, they have a different identity, really. I mean, Tony was amazing, and Hannibal Lecter can be played in many, many different ways. Churchill is a real person, so in a way you've got to acknowledge his reality much more than, you know, you're in a way you're more free when you do somebody like that. And also, Michael Mann wanted to do something very psychological about Hannibal Lecter. There was none of that in any of that stuff, you know. He didn't want that. That would have been completely inappropriate. And I wouldn't have done it anyway, you know, because I'm not that kind of actor. I mean, Tony is, and he's brilliant at it.
I think it's time to talk about Succession and your role as Logan Roy. You touched there on your conversations with Jesse Armstrong and Adam McKay. But did they write it for you? Did Jesse Armstrong write it for you?
I think Jesse had me in mind for it. There's no question about that. I don't know. I mean, he might have written it, but he certainly did eventually. Because I kept saying less. You know, I didn't want to. I just felt that Logan was a man of mystery. I didn't want to kind of, you know, so because I said, let the kids hang themselves by their own words rather than Logan kind of, you know, he doesn't, I mean, it's terribly painful for him, but at the same time, don't exacerbate the pain by making him overwork it. And it became an almost perfect part to play in that way because it was very spare. And it worked. It was also funny too, the great humor that he had. But the writing, it was the writing. You can't do anything if you don't have the writers. And Jesse, you know, his vision. Because people got very upset when I died and people said, oh, you left. You know, I kind of agree with them that I think I left too early. But I did say to people, it's called Succession.
What did you feel about them making you die off stage, you know, rather than giving you a Shakespearean death?
No, I like that. Because the possibility is he may not be dead. No, I love that because there's a sort of ambiguous thing about it, you know, and the fact that, and of course it worked brilliantly. I mean, because it was such a shock for the audience that suddenly there he is giving that amazing speech at the TV studio to his workers, you know, and then boom, you know, he's gone. I just felt that the problem with the show was, and I think Jesse agrees, well, I know he agrees because we've talked about it, that I think the problem with the show was that, you know, we'd already seen so much of the kids and what they'd been through. So there was a lot of replay of stuff. You know, there was a lot of stuff that we'd already been through. So there might have been a different way of doing that, you know. And I think instead of dying in 3, I think he should have died in 5 or 6, you know. But he should have, no question, he should have died. I didn't have any problem with it when Jesse said, I said, well, it was obvious, you know. I mean, everybody was hoping we might do a 5th season. I really have such respect for Jesse because a lot of these shows go well past their sell-by date. You know, they go well past and they just start to diminish. But that is not the case with Succession. I think it's a great show and it had its perfect timing.
Let's play a clip. While his children are spoiled, privileged, and entitled, Logan Roy is not. He has had to work for everything he's got. Let's play this clip where Logan points out this difference between himself and his children and his entourage.
How much is a gallon of milk?
What?
How much is a gallon of milk?
I don't know. I mean, who the fuck knows, Dad? Literally, no one knows. Who gives a shit?
Ray! Yeah? How much is a gallon of milk?
Like a regular milk or?
I am surrounded by snakes and fucking morons. You're a bunch of silk stocking fucks. Who backs me on Pierce? Who?
None of them do, Dad. They're all against it. Okay, Carl's lying, Ray's lying, Jerry's playing both sides.
Well,
Here's news. We are going after it. And what's more, I will win.
The guy who really deserves the credit for that is Tony Roach, who wrote that episode. But we wondered if it was too much. We wondered if it was, if we were seeing too much of the kind of demonic element of Logan. But actually, it worked like a dream. In a way, it was right. It was, that's the little piggy stuff when it gets really out of hand.
Is the contrast between Logan and his kids? Yeah. They are privileged. He was not. He's had to fight for everything he's got.
You know, this is why it's not Rupert Murdoch, because Rupert Murdoch already inherited something. Logan is a self-made man, really self-made man. I also think that Logan was a sort of, you know, they always say that a cynic is a destroyed romantic. And I think Logan had that romantic element about him when he was young that was kind of brutalized out of him. And he became the man that we see, you know. And that was my journey on the part, you know. So I kept saying, I don't want anything that says that he had any form of privilege. And he doesn't. He has a sister who died, who had polio, and he may have helped, he may have infected her. There's all of that, which we don't see. And then we have a scene where he's swimming and he's got scars on his back. And we don't explain it. We just say, so it's up to the audience to take that. This is what I also, back to the American actors, is let the audience make decisions. Don't make decisions on their behalf. Just present what you have to present. That's what's great about being an audience, because you think, oh, he's going to go this. Oh, he didn't. He went that way. Oh, that's good, because he's going to go. Oh, no, he's going to go that. You know, that's what's great about it. And if you're second guessing that as the actor or the director or the writer, you're not doing the job, you know.
Well, I was reading about one of your co-stars, Jeremy Strong, and when he was a child, he had posters on his wall, Daniel Day-Lewis, Dustin Hoffman, and Al Pacino. So he's very much steeped in the method.
He was, believe it or not, he was Dan's assistant for a while. So, oh yes, he was. He was Dan Day-Lewis's assistant, so I think there's a link.
And how did that sit with the four kids and Logan?
Well, it was not. Ultimately, it was fine. And the great thing about Jeremy, he's a great actor. There's no question about his acting. He's great. And when it comes to doing a scene with him, it's the best. You know, I loved playing with him. It's just all the other shit I couldn't stand, you know. Which is, to me, unnecessary. But he's a wonderful, wonderful actor. And he puts himself through it, and I don't think there's any need to do that, because we have to be flexible. We have to be endlessly sort of able to just buy into something which perhaps comes from outfield that we didn't expect. But what it could do is reveal something else that we thought about, you know. And I think sometimes when you do that, you cut yourself off from the possibility of growth in a different direction.
And does it cut you off from other characters and actors in their process of what they're doing with their character?
Well, no, because it is selfish, ultimately selfish. But if you look at American films and you look at the great American character actors that make up a film, you look at a Preston Sturges film or a Howard Hawks film, of course it may be Cary Grant and maybe Katharine Hepburn in the lead, but the supporting cast is what makes the film. And they can do their job that much easier because everything else is right. That's what it's about. It's as much about the ensemble as anything else.
Now, not wanting to sound like the Roy children, but is Brian Cox going to retire ever?
Never. Now, as my mother used to say, you're a long time dead. The older you get, the work becomes more interesting.
Before we finish, would it be rude to ask you, what does Logan Roy think of his four children?
Well, no, not at all. The thing about it is, I think we all love our children, but we don't always like them. You know, I have four children, and I love them deeply, but at times I don't like them. There are moments when I think, oh, for fuck's sake, behave yourself, you know. But there are other times when they're the best. And it's complicated. You know, being a parent is very complicated. And so but he does love his children. And he says it brilliantly when he says, you know, I love you all, but you're not serious people. That was my favorite line in the whole program, you know, was when he says that, because that's the truth. They're not really committed in a way. They're only committed to themselves. Whereas Logan is committed to Waystar Royko, and that's all he asks of his kids. And they can't, they want it, you know, they want it for their own purposes, but they don't want it to serve. And that's the big difference. But he does love his children.
Does he have a favorite?
He did have. I think Siobhan was his favorite. Ironically, if he'd gone on, I think Roman was becoming the favorite child. I think he'd given up on Kendall because of just Kendall's such a mess, you know. And Shiv can't shut the fuck up for 5 minutes. I mean, she's just, you know. I mean, she starts off brilliant, and you go, oh, for God's sake. Connor is his first child. So, in a way, Connor is special. The disappointment is deep, but it's long. It's long, the disappointment with him. And I think as he went on, I think Logan was beginning to really think, well, Connor has certain things which are not too bad. And Kieran's character, Roman's character, solved things like the Middle East money. He knew about that. So there was great perception in him that, you know, if we'd gone on, it would have been interesting to see. But, you know, he still loves him. You know, and there's always hope that they might get better. He's on a hiding to nothing, but, you know.
It's time to draw this wonderful conversation with Brian Cox to an end. Brian, thank you for sharing your time, your stories, and your wisdom with us. I would like to thank Galway Film Fla and the Irish Film and Television Academy for inviting Arena to the Film Festival, to our sound team for RTE, Damien Chanels, and for the Film Fla, Dave Morn and Keith Fahey. And a special thanks to Heather Higgins. For Arena, Declan Burke and Barbara Rose Sanwu Research, Reg Luby is the producer, and a big thank you to this wonderful audience in Galway, and thank you to our star guest, Brian Cox.
Thank you.